This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with Ayah 260 to 263 of Surah Baqarah, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَإِذْ قَالَ إِبْرَاهِيمُ رَبِّ أَرِنِي كَيْفَ تُحْيِي الْمَوْتَى قَالَ أَوَلَمْ تُؤْمِنْ قَالَ بَلَى وَلَكِنْ لِيَطْمَئِنَّ قَلْبِي قال فخذ أربعة من الطير فصرهن إليك ثم اجعل على كل جبل منهن جزءا ثم ادعهن يأتينك سعيا واعلم أن الله عزيز حكيم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة 100 حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون قول معروف ومغفرة خير من صدقة يتبعها أذى والله غني حليم.
In the name of Allah, and when Abraham said, My Lord, show me how you revive the dead. He said, Do you not believe? He said, Yes, indeed, but in order that my heart may be at rest. He said, Take 4 of the birds, then cut them into pieces, and place a part of them on every mountain. Then call them, they will come to you, hastening, and know that Allah is Almighty and All-Wise. Those who spend their wealth in the way of Allah and then do not follow what they have spent with reproaches and affronts, they shall have their reward near their Lord, and they will have no fear, nor will they grieve. An honorable word with pardon is better than a charity followed by a affront, and Allah is all-sufficient, most forbearing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, FM, and satellites. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Hidden files. For months, we have now been witnessing horrific scenes coming out of Gaza as we have watched the Israeli genocide continue there. As we know, the problem Palestinians have with Zionists did not start on October the 7th. But why is it that many people in the world are just finding out about this story? And now that they have found out, what could it mean? Well, stay with us as we take a look at this and more on this Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashemi, and welcome to the show. Today, we're going to talk to an American journalist who was just as misinformed as most Americans, but then did research on the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and what she discovered would change her life, but also change the life of many others forever.
Here is an American activist and writer known for her interest in the topic of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. She's the founder and executive director of the nonprofit organization If Americans Knew, president of the Council for the National Interest, and author of Against Our Better Judgment, The Hidden History of How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel.
I'd like to welcome journalist Allison Ware to the program. Allison, thank you so much for being with us here on Hidden Files. What would you say, as an American journalist and editor of a small town weekly in Sausalita, turn your attention to the issue of Israel and Palestine to begin with?
As you say, I was just the editor of a very small newspaper, so I was not covering international news at all. But in the fall of 2000, when my youngest son had left home for the university, and I had a little more time just to be curious about things, the Second Intifada was in the news in the U.S. So I was seeing these images of sometimes children throwing stones against tanks and, I decided for the first time in my life to pay attention to the issue of Israel-Palestine. You know, for most Americans, that seems very far away, confusing if you're not Jewish. You don't feel it has any real connection to you. But in this case, I was curious, so I looked into the, I decided to follow the news coverage. And when I did that, I noticed that it seemed very one-sided. As a journalist, as you know, you're supposed to look into the full story and hear from different people. And I noticed that we were hearing from and about Israelis in great detail, as I wanted. But then I thought and expected that I would hear from and about Palestinians also, since there are two parties in that conflict. And I noticed that came much less frequently. So I felt I was really getting one side of an important story. Google and the internet was pretty new back then, but I realized that was a resource I could try to use to learn more about what was going on. And I started to do some internet searches, which was brand new. And I discovered that there were news sources in the region itself that were giving information day by day, sometimes hour by hour. So after work, I would start looking into those. And I learned that unarmed Palestinians were being killed every day in large numbers, many of them children. This was covered in considerable detail. I also learned that the U.S. was at that time giving Israel $8 million per day. I'd never known that, and I think almost nobody knew that. It was never mentioned in U.S. news coverage. So I saw that there were really atrocities and human rights violations going on every day using my tax money, and yet it was not being covered in the American media. So it seemed to me this was the biggest cover-up I had ever seen.
Well, Allison, tell me about your trip to Palestine. I think that trip changed your professional life.
That changed the course of my life. Yes, after a few months of doing that, I began to think this was so important. I needed to go and see for myself what was going on. So in February and March of 2001, before the 9/11 attack, you know, many months before the attacks on the World Trade Center, I traveled over to Gaza and the West Bank as a freelance journalist. I traveled around by myself. This was before the ISM movement. So I was there just as a journalist with my notebook and small camera. And I saw firsthand what was going on. I saw firsthand small children who'd been shot. I was in the home of a family whose little son had just been killed by Israeli forces. I went through neighborhoods in Gaza that were already bullet-riddled. You know, I remember thinking it seemed like pictures I had seen of World War II. Massive destruction in some of those neighborhoods.
And this was you said 2001.
That's right, early 2001. So this is long. No Palestinian rockets had been fired yet. Hamas was not in charge yet. That was many years in the future. And it was already, there were already these major attacks on Palestinians, also in the West Bank and in Gaza. Children being shot, people being shot, homes being destroyed, shelling of entire neighborhoods, both in Gaza and in the West Bank. So I saw that and experienced firsthand. And when I came back to the United States, I decided to start an organization that would be non-ideological. It would be to reach every American across the political spectrum of every religion and ethnicity. And I named it If Americans Knew, because I felt if other Americans knew what I at that time knew, we would have very different U.S. policies.
Well, Allison, what do you think is the most important aspect of U.S. and Israeli relationships that if Americans knew, it would make a difference?
There are a number of things. One of the main things to start with is that we are giving Israel massive amounts of money, so therefore we're responsible for what Israel does. And it gives us a connection. Many people, as you know, are busy raising children, working jobs, trying to keep things together. There are many important issues around the world and in the United States. So when this just seemed like a faraway, distant, confusing issue, most people don't pay enough attention to it. But when they realize, wait, we give more of our tax money to this tiny country than anywhere else, I'd better pay attention. So I think it's first learning that they have a very significant connection to it. And then when they learn what's going on, there's the human reality of seeing the tragedy that's being done to Palestinians that began, you know, over 75 years ago. It's not new. And beginning to learn the history of it, I know about every issue from the American media, yes. Often from broadcast media, you know, radio and TV. And so the key is what's the information there? And much of it's being covered up. Much of it's just not there. When they do learn about Gaza, some of the reports barely mention the fact of what's actually going on. There'll be a few seconds maybe, and then they'll focus on the Israeli hostages and make them humanize their families, and never hear about the, you know, many thousands of Palestinian prisoners that are held without trial, without charge, often physically abused, certainly psychologically abused. So the problem is that most people that try to pay attention to the news on this issue are often getting very incomplete news, sometimes really fallacious news.
I mean, what would you say the effect on people watching this ongoing genocide take place in real time?
I think many of us, it's just excruciating. I think many people around the world and, you know, many of us just find it horrific to watch day after day after day. Right. Hundreds more people being killed every day, many of them, most of them women and children, and just going on day after day after day. The thing that's different about this genocide than many in the past is that we are seeing it. Those of us that know where to look, that follow Al Jazeera and Press TV and other places, are learning these facts every day. And it's astounding to me that it can continue without the world stopping it, that it continues day after day without people stopping it. And then I realize when I go around, you know, my small town and areas that many people have no idea this is, you know, many of us are following it and seeing it every hour. There are other people that live near us and, you know, within our geographic area who aren't even aware of what's being done to children.
I mean, so you're saying in the middle of this genocide that there's still many people that don't even know about it?
I think many don't. I've been trying recently to watch. I record the news broadcasts, but I haven't had time to be watching them very much. And I just watched what Fox TV has been having. And, you know, I saw that recently they did show briefly images of Gaza, and they did have a brief interview, you know, with, not an interview, but someone, I think it was UNICEF or a humanitarian agency, mentioning about what was going on, but it was just on screen for a few seconds. Mm-hmm. And this was in the context of Hamas being depicted as terrorists, that Gazans are, you know, that anything that's happening in Gaza is the fault of Hamas, that it's really Israel that's suffering. There was a report about the Houthi attacks on shipping without any explanation about why they were doing it, why this was, you know, perceived by many people as a very understandable action, given that there's a genocide going on and everybody in the world has an obligation to try to stop it, try to get the world to stop it. But that didn't come through in the news coverage.
Stay with us. We're going to continue our discussion with Allison Weir right after this short break. Stay with us.
Who owns U.S. media? Six media companies control 90% of U.S. media. Four out of those six companies are Time Warner, Comcast, Disney, and News Corp. Asset management firms own large shares in companies that sell weapons of war, and they also own large shares of mainstream media organizations. BlackRock, Inc. and the Vanguard Group, Inc. hold large shares in the world's largest arm-producing company, Lockheed Martin Corp., as well as Raytheon, and the group also partial owns mainstream news media organizations. NBC is owned by Comcast. Comcast is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. ABC is owned by Disney, and Disney is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. Times is owned by Time Warner, and Time Warner is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. CBS is owned by Viacom CBS, which is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. Fox News is owned by News Corp, which is owned by BlackRock and Vanguard. As the genocide in Gaza continues, it is not likely that Americans will be able to get the true story of what is happening. This is as long as their media is owned by corporations, and several of those corporations are parts of the military-industrial complex. a conflict of interest, to say the least.
Well, thanks so much for staying with us. Allison, I'd like to continue with looking at the journalist side of everything happening in Gaza. Basically, no one is safe, and so many journalists have been killed in record numbers, and yet we really don't hear the condemnation from mainstream journalists that we should be. Why is that the case?
Yeah, there are some groups, some international groups are making strong statements, but most people don't hear about those. I find that especially, you know, as I say, just the last day or two, I've been focusing on Fox, so I know the other media are also bad, but right now I'm really, really most aware of the Fox coverage. And truthfully, I've thought this is an intentional obstruction of people learning the facts. To me, it's not the journalists that are doing it. They're mouthpieces. I think it's shameful. But what's going on is clearly somebody at the top has decreed that they are not there to give as little information as possible to the American public. I don't think this is just the, you know, mistakes, as you know, with daily news coverage, mistakes can be made, or, you know, operating on a, you know, fairly urgent time scale to try to get the news out. So I don't object when people make a mistake or get things, you know, in a day or two. But the kind of pattern that is becoming apparent as I look at these past broadcasts is that this is an intentional editorial policy that's being made by someone at the top. And it's being carried out by their news directors down below. There's no doubt that that's going on. What I've often focused on the Israel lobby in the United States, because most people are not very aware of that, and there's a real effort to cover up that aspect. Even people that will talk about the human rights violations and the violence often try to cover up the fact that there's a very powerful, very pervasive pro-Israel lobby in the United States that operates in every state, is certainly very, very off, very influential in Washington, D.C., in the media, on campuses, that plays an important role in this.
I mean, you just talked about the Israeli lobby, and it's absolutely amazing the amount of money that is spent by the Israeli lobby in basically buying American politicians. And still, many Americans don't realize the connection between the politicians and the Israeli lobby.
That's right. And the financial connection is enormous. You know, already it ranges from about $4 to $5 billion per year, which works out to over $10 million per day. But then on top of this, at the end of 2023, there was an effort by Biden and by Congress to give Israel an additional $14 billion.
I mean, do you think that the genocide will have an effect on redefining international law as we are watching this total failure of the so-called international rules-based system?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. Certainly, what's going on at the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, will be very interesting to see what results from that. The presentations there on behalf of South Africa of documenting that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian population were very articulate, extremely compelling, powerful, persuasive. Of course, most Americans didn't see them. I'm waiting to see what happens, like the rest of the world. Will they find the appropriate finding for the court, or will the governments, because I'm afraid of the power of the United States government, which basically does, as we're seeing with Biden, what Israel tells the U.S. to do, and then therefore the U.S. pressures other governments. Will that make a difference, or will justice actually be served in this case? I think it's an important thing to watch and see what happens. So far, the world has failed. There's no doubt that so far the world has failed to do what should be done, which was to stop the massacres that are going on every day and the other abuses. The, you know, U.S. has enabled it. Biden has sent our weapons over there to perpetuate it, more money. The Arab nations, sadly, are not using their power to stop Israel. The European nations are failing to use their power to stop Israel. So you know, the population around the world, I think, is trying very hard. There are these massive marches. Many people are writing articles and trying to document what's going on. And so there's major effort by people around the world to stop the atrocities, but the powerful and the governments of the world are failing to use their power to stop this. I don't know when or if that will change.
But you just mentioned about people taking to the streets to protest against this genocide. But do you think that it's also causing an awakening in them about their own governments who are not listening to them and continuing to support the genocide?
I think it certainly is a transitional moment for many people. We saw a comment on one of our Instagram posts today, someone saying, you know, I'm completely ashamed. I had no awareness of this before. But the comment said, now, like millions of people, I'm catching up and I'm learning about it. So I think for many people, it's an aha moment. Like, how did I not know about this? How did I, you know, I thought I cared about human rights. And I didn't even know about this ongoing human rights that started long, long before the last few months. So I think for many individuals, I think I believe there's a movement going on in the U.S. that I think it's still going on among the Muslim Americans. Some of the organizations are that have supported Biden, thinking he would be better than Trump, and have seen that he's not. So there's a movement to use the vote and say, abandon Biden, to not vote for somebody because he's supposedly the lesser of two evils, but to show that people will no longer vote for somebody who continues to fund genocide. I think that would be a major movement if more people do that. And if candidates realize that they will lose the election because they're doing the wrong thing, they're pleasing their campaign donors, they're pleasing the billionaires that fund their campaigns. But if they say that doesn't work, the voters will still vote against them and they'll lose the election. That could have a major impact. It has in the past. In my long life, I've seen major changes in the United States. In some of our domestic policies, and in the Vietnam War being ended, apartheid in South Africa ending. So I've never seen a genocide of this proportion, I don't think. At least I've never seen something, you know, this ongoing massacres day after day after day, funded by my tax money. I don't think I've seen something this bad before, but I have seen other things that were very bad that have been stopped, that the world has sometimes stopped. So I still have hope, you know, I have to have hope that we will somehow, all the work that all of us are doing in journalism, in activism, in academia, on campuses, in churches, in mosques, that all of that eventually will counter the power of the elites that seem to want this to continue.
What do you think is the responsibility of your fellow journalists at this time in covering this genocide and the overall Palestinian story?
I think the obligation is the obligation that we always have, which is tell the real facts, find the real facts, and tell them. Don't water it down. Don't give it spin. Don't leave things out because they're too graphic. I think the obligation is to tell people what's going on. The real life, what's happening to human beings in Gaza and in the West Bank, that it's our obligation to tell the facts, whether or not our governments want us to, whether or not we will, you know, many of us have paid a personal cost for doing this. But that's one of the things we have to do. It's important for everyone to do that.
But you've just talked about the personal cost, Allison, and I know you've paid a price for choosing the reality of the Palestinian story and talking about it all these years. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I have. You know, it's very small, of course, compared to what people in the Middle East are feeling. But so it's a small personal cost. But, you know, I'm called names. I've been called anti-Semitic. People imply that I'm a bigot. They don't imply it. They say that, even though I have a life history of opposing all bigotry. I've been called a communist or a white supremacist. My children have sometimes, it's been uncomfortable for them because then people hear things about their mother that are untrue. I've had death threats. I think that's what happens to anybody and everybody that works on this issue. But I've, you know, fortunately, I've also received some awards for my work and some people have praised it. So I've had negative things, but I've also had positive things. And most of all, I know that I'm doing something that I have to do. So at least I can feel about myself that I'm doing the right thing. And I think that's more important than any of the negatives I've had.
Well, do you have any final words about this continuing genocide and just the overall situation? Final words.
I think it's just appalling that it continues day after day and that we haven't stopped it. It will have major repercussions on the world. I think it could grow into a regional war. There are indications that Israel would like that because it would give them the chance to do even more of an ethnic cleansing than they're doing now. So bad as it is now, I'm afraid it could end up, it's already involving Yemen.
Thank you so much for being with us, Allison, on Hidden Files. Well, all of us must ask ourselves, what is our responsibility during this crisis, no matter where one is and what he or she does? He or she can do something. It could be as simple as explaining what is going on in Gaza to a friend. From east to west, we've seen people taking to the streets to protest this genocide. Politicians may not show a reaction to these protests in public, but for sure it is making a difference. The pressure must be continued, and journalists all over the world must do their best to explain the real story of Palestine to help in this genocide, occupation, and siege on the Palestinian nation. I'm Marzia Hashemi for Hidden Files, and thanking you for being with us on another program. Goodbye.
With you. How about you? Arabi English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
Why there is a need for a government which will be established by the Wali of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
In one of the letters that he writes to Sheikh Mufid, he tells us one of the ways that we can end the ghibah.
Let us see how one can prepare for the advent of the zuhur of Imam Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Mahdi, alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. Please stay tuned. The 12th divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is the one who brings hope to all of humanity. As the world is being grinded between the oppressors and tyrants of the age, we look towards the heavens so that the advent of the 12th divinely appointed Imam comes sooner. We raise our hands in prayers and we raise our hands in supplications so that the awaited Savior of humanity comes and brings the final hope and salvation that humanity is so yearning for and desiring. The sights and the eyes of the world are looking towards the advent of this great Savior Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance so that his eminence comes to establish the divine rule of the Almighty Allah for every single human being, is completely dependent and needs this divine rule of the Almighty Allah. And it is this divine rule of the Almighty Allah, the kingdom of God that is to be established by Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, which will bring about ultimate justice in a world which is filled with cruelty and injustice. Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we're talking about a dialogue that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, the awaited savior of humanity, has with Uthman ibn Sa'id. It's an interesting conversation. It has some different themes that we are, inshallah, going to be speaking about. And so we find that when speaking with Uthman ibn Sa'id, we find that Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, he says that he seeks refuge in the Almighty Allah from blindness after light and vision. And he seeks refuge in Allah from deviation after guidance and from evil deeds and dangerous mischiefs. And then he talks about a verse from the Holy Quran, which if we have time, we will speak about. But here, so interesting that sometimes, you know, throughout our lives, we are blessed with light and knowledge and wisdom. We are blessed with guidance and we are blessed with this divine knowledge and we are blessed with good deeds and we are blessed with certainty. But then for some reason, you know, either it is the attacks and insinuations of Satan, or perhaps, you know, the media that we consume, or perhaps even the people that we speak to, we end up turning this light and this vision into blindness. We end up turning this guidance into deviation. And we end up turning our good deeds and our certainty into evil deeds and suspicion. And so we do it to ourselves, and we have to be very careful as we get closer to the advent of Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance. You know, we will find that these kind of things will become worse, meaning blindness and darkness and oppression will increase, deviation will increase, evil deeds, suspicions will increase. As time moves forward, because as the advent of Imam al-Mahdi, may Allah hasten his reappearance, comes closer and closer, the forces of Satan and Satan himself will start to panic and they will push harder and harder to prevent the advent, but also to confuse the people when the advent does occur. So we have to be very careful with the media that we consume. We have to be very careful with the people that we associate with and we speak to. We have to be very careful where we go, what we read, because we are living in an age where these kind of things will happen. And so, you know, we again have to be very careful. We have to read the Holy Quran. We have to read the traditions of the infallible and immaculate Imams alayhim wasalam, the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, and good religious righteous scholars, you know, and even if it is going towards the past, for example, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi, may Allah have peace and blessings upon him. Imam Khomeini is an individual that definitely we must read his words, and Imam Khamenei, of course, in the present day, is another individual who we should be following and we should be listening to His Eminence's statements. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif. IRIB English Radio. Please follow our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
I would like to talk about this phenomenon of ghibat, occultation. Sheikh Sadogh, again, in his very popular book, he actually wrote this book in the, after the Ghibat-i-Kubra, when there was confusion among some people. And the entire book actually was written to clarify this doubt that some people had at that time. And in there, he has a narration from Kumail bin Ziyad through five different chains of narrations, separate ones. And this is where you see the authenticity of that narration. And actually, this is a conversation that Amir al-Mu'minin had with Kumail bin Ziyad about importance of knowledge compared to wealth. It's there also in Nahj al-Balagha. But in Nahj al-Balagha, it doesn't have the source. It doesn't give you the sanad. Whereas Sheikh Sadogh has given you five chains of narrations about this conversation of Ali with Kumail bin Ziyad. And not only, you know, Sheikh Sadogh, actually even one of the Sunni writers, Ibn Asakir, in his famous book known as Tariq Dimashq, he also has multiple chains of narrations for this quotation of Amir al-Mu'mineen and his conversation with Kumail. This is where he says to Kumail, oh Kumail, you know, he took him actually outside the town of Kufa. Nobody was there. Kumail was one of those where Amir al-Mu'mineen kind of would talk, you know, things which were in his heart. He would open up. And there he says to Kumail, Kumail, you know, when you look at knowledge, it's more superior to wealth, because knowledge is the ruler, whereas wealth is ruled upon. When you use knowledge, it increases in usage, whereas when it comes to wealth, the more you use, it becomes less. You know, and then he talks about the legacy of knowledge continues even after the scholars have died. What is the legacy of those who have money? You know, even if they are alive, nobody knows about them. And then, you know, about talking about it in detail, then Ali says something. He says, oh, Kumail, my heart or my chest, he uses the word sadri, this is filled with knowledge that Allah has given to me. I would like to share it with people, but I don't see those who are worthy of even, you know, receiving it. At that point, then Ali says something very profound, relevant to the Imam of the time. He says, Allahumma bala. He says, I don't see those people who are, you know, worthy of receiving what I have. Allahumma bala, la taqlu al-ardha min qa'imin bihujjatin. Zahirin mashhur aw khaifin maghmur. He says, by Allah. Let me go to English. I'll come to the Urdu at the end. He says, by Allah, yes, the earth will never be without one who stands up with the divine proof. The earth will only always have someone, you know, who will stand up for the divine proof, and he would be either visible and known to the people, or he will be in the state of fear and hidden. Imam-i-Ghaib, this concept, Ali is talking about to Kumail long, long before the birth of our Imam Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajah Sharif.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Columbia University Palestine Solidarity Coalition pointed out that former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has personally participated in war crimes, namely the Kana massacre that murdered over 100 civilians and United Nations peacekeepers. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. I've killed many Arabs in my life and there's no problem with that. In the United States, such a statement grants you the privilege of conducting a speaking tour across prestigious Ivy League universities, and any opposition to it and the Zionist regime responsible for such killings leads to suspension, expulsion, and possibly even arrest. This vile statement was made by former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett in 2013, who recently embarked on a speaking tour across various U.S. institutions, including Ivy League universities such as Columbia, Harvard, and Liberty University. Naftali Bennett is among the worst of Zionist criminals, with a track record drenched in blood. He was a military officer during the April of 1996 Kana massacre in Lebanon, where Israel murdered over 100 civilians who were seeking shelter and safety during the illegal Zionist occupation. In an investigation conducted by the Electronic Intifada, it was revealed that Naftali Bennett greenlit the indiscriminate and horrifying shelling, which struck a UNIFIL base. The Israeli occupation of Lebanon in the 1990s, in which Naftali Bennett was a veteran, was marked by horrendous war crimes and the intentional targeting of civilians and civil infrastructure. Yet Naftali Bennett's commitment of flagrant war crimes did not end there. During his premiership, he oversaw egregiously illegal settler expansion into the occupied West Bank, violating international laws and worse, committing crimes against humanity on a daily basis. Bennett's university tour in the United States was centered on whitewashing Israeli war crimes and defending the Zionist occupation. The tour was an attack on the boycott, divestment and sanctions BDS movement, which has successfully pressured prominent brands to distance themselves from Israeli genocidal regime and its allies. The tour was an aggressive defense of the genocide perpetrated by the Israeli regime over the past 17 months in the Gaza Strip. It sought to leverage institutional resources and funding to ensure Bennett's speeches proceed uninterrupted, leading to a violent crackdown on student dissent. Indeed, academia has become a battleground for the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, arguably its primary arena within the United States. In April of 2024, student encampments were launched nationwide, calling for the disclosure and divestment of university ties to Israeli institutions. While Zionist media tends to dismiss university collaborations as harmless, organizations like the Israel Institute actively promote Zionist racist ideology within university curricula, even going so far as to craft Zionist-aligned course materials and deploy Israeli professors with Israeli military backgrounds. Students have demanded an end to these collaborations and full transparency regarding any ties to the Israeli occupation. While Naftali Bennett is welcomed with open arms, dissent and opposition to Israeli curricula and speakers are met with threats of expulsion and arrest. U.S. President Donald Trump has vowed to crack down on the Palestinian Solidarity Movement, threatening universities with the withdrawal of federal funding should they continue allowing students to criticize the Israeli regime. Donald Trump perpetuates the false equivalency of anti-Zionism and anti-Judaism, using this narrative to justify pulling federal funding if universities fail to act against Palestine solidarity organizers. He has even threatened to deport migrant students on visas if they engage in criticism of the Tel Aviv regime or participate in protest activities against Israel. However, these threats have not deterred students. Undeterred, students at Columbia University protested against Naftali Bennett despite being barred from entering his speaking event. The following day, they returned to Columbia University and occupied a hall within Barnard College, echoing the tactics employed by the same student movement last year. Barnard College recently expelled students involved in the previous year's protests, reigniting campus demonstrations just as Naftali Bennett arrived. Effectively, caving to pressure from the Trump administration, Columbia University officials immediately called the New York Police Department on the protesters, who proceeded to brutalize the students. Yet these brave students, whose numbers remain undiminished and perhaps even reinforced compared to last semester's actions, are undaunted by the threats from both the university and the Trump administration. The students have vowed to continue their struggle against the university's Zionist collaborations, while the Student Government Association has condemned the New York Police Department's actions in a letter addressed to the Barnard College president. Website Palestine Chronicle has also covered the same story. Rather than dying down as World Zionism and the U.S. government had hoped, the student movement in the United States is instead re-strategizing and resurging. Former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett's tour has only further mobilized American university students, not just in New York, but also at its stops at Harvard University and Ohio State University. Students at Ohio State University demonstrated against Naftali Bennett, once again dismissing President Donald Trump's threats. The Ohio Student Association fired back at Donald Trump, publishing a statement that directly addressed the repression. "We are calling out injustice and demanding accountability. Our voices create real change, and we won't be silenced. This is our right, and no authoritarian threat will take it away from us." Students at Harvard University also actively mobilized against Naftali Bennett, declaring that they will not welcome Zionist war criminals into Harvard University. As the saying goes, repression breeds resistance. The student movement and the Palestinian Solidarity Movement as a whole understands that the Trump administration, in lockstep with World Zionism, is attempting to quickly wrap things up with the Palestinian movement, as it has exposed the role of American imperialism and threatened the very legitimacy of institutions once taken for granted in American society. Recognizing Donald Trump's tactics, the movement knows that conceding an inch means giving up a mile. Solidarity activists understand that repression is merely a reaction to the growing popularity of the Palestinian cause. Yielding to such threats would mean surrendering hard-fought gains. The Palestinian solidarity movement has profoundly transformed the fabric of student society in America, forcing institutions sustained by the decaying fruits of imperialism to either change course or face disruption and illegitimacy. American universities pride themselves on being incubators of free thought, expression, and the leaders of tomorrow. Students are now challenging this claim while the state scrambles to suppress the growing popularity of the Palestinian cause. The Palestinian cause is here to stay, and it will certainly grow, much to the dismay of Zionist imperialists.
Thank you.